All right, team, Coach Dana Cavalier here with you on the Becoming a Champion show. And today I sit down with the founder of Rind, Mr. Matt Weiss. It's an amazing interview. He shares his story, how he got the brand started, how he's working to disrupt the snack category, and how he was inspired by his great-grandmother, Helen, to start this brand. And it's a real cool story because he didn't start till he was 39, 40 years old, had a career in finance and said, hey, I'm going to follow my passion and I'm going to follow my dream. And man, when he shares the story about his first sale, it's amazing. So sit back and enjoy my sit down with Mr. Matt Weiss. Hey, Matt.
Coach Dana, how are you?
Good. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. Nice to connect. Nice to meet you.
Likewise. Likewise. You in New York?
I am. Yeah, I'm in Rind World Headquarters in Manhattan.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So you live full-time in the city?
I do. Yeah, raising my family here against all logic and common sense, but
that's all right.
Listen, we're making it work.
It has an energy to it, right?
It sure does. I was listening to a couple of your other pods before this. Sounds like you have some greener pastures upstate, which must be nice.
I have greener pastures upstate, but I do find myself quite often downstate, down in, New York City and Long Island. And then we spent a good amount of time in Florida too. So nice. I can't complain about that part. Not this time of year.
I grew up in Florida and all my friends are like, what are you doing up there? Time to come back, but maybe when I'm retired.
What brought you up there? I mean, what brought you to New York?
It is one of those things where the grass is always greener. I loved growing up in Miami. I was out sports year round, digging in the dirt. I took it for granted and I wanted big city energy.
Yeah.
Because it's what I didn't have. I went to school in North Carolina. I kind of worked my way up the East Coast and, came to the city because my sister was living and working here in the entertainment industry. And I just fell in love. So been here ever since.
You know, it's funny. We have some friends down here. We're outside of Jupiter and they're from here, born and raised Floridians. And for the first time, a couple weeks ago, my buddy was running the marathon in New York and they went up there and he's like, "But I could live up here. The energy is amazing." You know, being a Florida kid, you don't get that same energy. Although I was in Miami last week and it's buzzing down there now.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's bumping. In the suburbs of Miami where I was, it wasn't, but
right.
There's just something about, I don't know, the pace of big ideas and dreamers and the ability to just take ideas and turn them into reality. It just feels more tangible and real here in New York. It's not to say you can't have amazing hotbeds of entrepreneurship elsewhere, but there's something I think about folks who self-select to the toughest town and make it work that creates a real exciting, set of circumstances.
It's the old Sinatra line, right? If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Ringing in my ears. It's just cheesy, but it's exactly like that.
Yeah, but it's true. You know, there's something that comes over you when you're up there. It's like a motivation. It's an energy. There's quite a bit of competition and you see, other great brands in your category and other categories. And it's like, hey, I want to compete on the biggest level and on the biggest scale. And,
exactly.
With New York, everything's right there for you to reach out and grab. So you got to go get it.
I like that a lot. It's felt, I didn't put my finger on that, but there is an element of the caliber of competitor in New York, whether it's in business or the arts or sports, really forces you to raise your game.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a healthy dynamic of competition as opposed to a sort of negative one. And what I love about now being here, I moved here when I was in my early 20s and now in my early 40s is that, while my kids aren't growing up with a backyard, they have a little bit of this hustle energy to them, which I actually love. And we've made the city a bit of our playground.
Yeah.
You know, I take him to school in the morning on like this giant electric bike wagon thing. And like, that's the carpool is like, you know, we'll just make it work.
Yeah. It's different. It's a different way to grow up. They'll learn skills that maybe they wouldn't acquire in another geography or part of the country. But, you know, New York is a pressure cooker. It's made for fighters. It's built for those that are looking to, you know, strap on those rocket engines. So that's cool. And listen, when you get tired of it, you could always come down to Florida again.
My folks are there. I love coming there. If I didn't have that as an outlet, I might feel differently, but I do feel like I get the best of both worlds because I get to visit family.
No, it's cool. So how did you, I was going to ask you, how did you start the company? Was it your first company? I mean, how did Rind come about?
Yeah, it was actually my second company. I've always been a bit of a restless mind. I just love to tinker and take things just up to an edge where it's uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Where usually I've always been doing it where I've had another full-time job. You know, now in the pandemic world, post-pandemic world, side hustle is a virtue. But, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when I was starting out, it felt a little illicit, like I was cheating on my job and it was taking up a lot of mind share. So what I have found is that when I push myself and I tinker with projects that I believe in, and some of them have a half-life of like a week, and then I'm just like, this idea has no legs or it's too half-baked.
Yeah.
Some take over my, you know, become like a white whale where I just believe in it so passionately that I just will things into reality. And this one was one, you know, was the one where I really poured my heart into and believed it, because the last 10 years in my career, I'd been covering food and beverage companies for a big mutual fund that I worked for. And I was researching the product market fit of some amazing brands and what allowed certain brands to capture imagination of the customer and of investors and of, you know, strategics. And I felt like I had learned a ton about where there were gaps in the market, and snacking, health and wellness, some big mega trends were happening, but this very sleepy had just the function. It was still a lot of raisins and prunes, sad. And that was a bit of the light bulb for me.
Mm, very cool. What were some of the discoveries you found in studying some of these other brands? Like that said, hey, I have an angle here. I can disrupt a bit here.
Yeah. So the biggest lesson I learned of the most successful brands were the ones that had leaders who articulated a bigger idea than just a product, that conveyed a platform that it had to be credible, but that there was real stretch to their brand if they could earn it. They had to earn it by being laser focused on, you know, absolutely dominating a niche or a category. But if they did that, did the brand offer dimension to go into an adjacent product category and sort of take the customer on this journey of, you know, we stand for XYZ, we stand for health, we stand for paleo, we stand for sustainability. And if you can earn it through one focus, then you have license, at least the brands I observed, to take the customer on a broader journey. Ultimately, that is what will allow you to grow year in and year out and not just be a one product brand.
Okay. So, but would you say, a lot of those companies, did they start with one signature product and then attach the journey to it? Or this, you know, how did they go about that?
Yeah,
how did you go about it too?
Yeah, I think you can't come to market and be taken seriously if you say, I'm going to be the market leader and disrupt trail mix, dried fruit, chips, you know, you name it. You have to prove it and prove the proof of concept in one field first. And I think that's true of most brands, but I think the entrepreneurs that get the bigger idea here understand that the starting point, even as simple as naming your brand and what it stands for, can either be limiting or open-ended. And so I'll give you an example. We happen to rhyme with them, which I love, but Kind Bar, you know, one of the pioneer brands of the natural foods industry, started in the early 2000s and has been an unbelievably successful business, over $1 billion in revenue, now acquired by Mars, started by an amazing entrepreneur in Daniel Lubetsky. And what I love about that is they had a hero product in their dark chocolate sea salt almond, you know, energy bar with ingredients you can see and pronounce. That was really important. The world didn't need another bar when he came around.
Right.
Nor did it need another bar when RX Bar came around, or Perfect Bar came around. But each of those entrepreneurs looked at a crowded market and said, how can I win by having a brand that has dimension and stretch? And I think each of them earned it with their hero, a hero SKU, but then were able to successfully expand their product portfolio so that there was really tremendous growth. And if for us, if our name were, you know, Matt's Dried Fruit Snacks, and I tried to move into crispy fruit chips or trail mix, I've made a mistake out of the gates.
Right.
And instead, we're rind. And what does that mean? It means there's more functional benefit in the skin of the ingredients that we use, whether it's fruits, whether it's vegetables, whether it's nuts or legumes. All of them have greater mineral and nutrient content by keeping the skin on. And that's a bigger idea than just one product category.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, I think of growing up as a kid and I would always want the skin off of things. And I would always hear my mother say, no, keep the skin on. That's where all the health is. Right. So I think as, you know, depending on how you grew up and when you grew up, you know, you may have heard that quite a bit. So this reinforces, you know, that positive concept as well, which is really not a concept. It's a truth.
Truth. And what I love is that I do think lots of people have someone in their lives who reminded them that there's power in the peel, as we say. Mm. And for me, I learned that, you know, I think things kind of skip a generation among consumer mentality and kind of what's old is new again. And you see a lot of folks walking around in like vintage stuff that their grandparents might have worn as like, you know, super dapper back in the day. And I think there is a nice momentum shift in a younger generation of snackers and consumers who really do care about where their product has come from, how it's been processed, what the brand says about their values and beliefs. You know, in the past it was, if it looked great, it meant it was highly processed, whether it was like, you know, Kraft mac and cheese or Wonder Bread. And I think what we've all learned over the last 10, 20 years is that products that look too good and look overly, you know, made to look the same batch to batch are highly processed and are not good for you versus whole fruit, gently dried, right? So I like that, you know, more and more people are recalling lessons they've learned from, whether it's moms, grandmoms. For me, it was a great grandmother who was a health food nut, who inspired me. And I think that's a good cross current that's helping our business right now.
Yeah. The consumer today is you know, more educated and desiring more education. I think you see that even in like farmers markets, sales are up and, you know, share programs. And even for us, like, you know, we started talking, we have a cattle farm and pasture raised pork farm upstate New York. We get a consumer that says, hey, I don't want to participate in this mass marketed strategy here. I'm looking for something that has certain benefits that I believe in. So it's right alongside that. It's cool. We're in a very powerful time and a great time. to give options and create options for that sort of consumer.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the combination of consumers having more information at their fingertips to know what their choices are, and then more options, more convenient ways of having access. And what was once maybe only found at high-priced natural food stores is now becoming more readily available.
Yeah.
Supply chain issues notwithstanding. But.
Right, exactly. So, Matt, for you, I'm just going to take a guess here. Did you start your career in finance?
Yeah, I did. But, you know, the firm I was working at was a very non-traditional Wall Street firm. One, it wasn't on Wall Street. I think everything gets painted with, you know, the same brush sometimes. And there's a lot of terms and they kind of all meld together, whether it's, you know, money management, Wall Street, hedge fund, mutual fund, and they're all, the strategies could be radically different.
Right.
And in my case, I worked for a mutual fund, which is about as plain vanilla as it can get. And more than that, it was a mutual fund led by just an unbelievably old school investor who helped pioneer mutual funds in the 80s.
Okay.
And had is somebody that I sought out as a mentor and who I learned a tremendous amount from, not just about how to analyze the prospects of a business, but how to bet on people.
Yeah.
And how to think about character qualities like integrity, their upbringing, their core values, their work ethic, how they treat their employees as, you know, qualitative inputs, but arguably almost as important or have as much weight in the analysis as the health of the business. And, you know, to me, most people don't think of Wall Street when you hear that.
Right.
But that was the firm I was at, and it's why I was there for 20 years, because I was just loving it, and I was a sponge. And the last 10 years, I was covering this food and beverage category, which I felt I found my tribe.
Yeah.
And it was hard to shake the desire to build a business of my own in this category and leave the field, you know, that I was familiar with, to be on the other side of the table as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's what I find interesting. So what was your age when you made that transition from, working for, you know, somebody and being a part of the firm to saying, hey, I'm going on my own. I'm now going to become an entrepreneur.
Maybe there's something about turning, the big 40.
All right.
It was right around, it was the cusp of 40. It was like 39, 40.
Okay.
You know, it's that middle ground where you've learned a ton over the last two decades of work out of college, but you're also looking ahead and you're seeing huge runway.
Yeah.
And I think it really was a crossroads where it felt like I could stay comfortable and stable and for the next 20, 30 years, but it didn't feel like I would be true to the passion pit that I had, and that I wouldn't grow as much, even if I took, it's hard to take risks as you get older, right? It's like you have more responsibility, people rely on you, you've built a life around a certain career, and now you're making a hard pivot. Nothing more of a pivot than investment research and to dried fruit.
Yeah.
But it's almost like once I made the decision and was honest with myself, it was such a relief. And it wasn't as scary as being dishonest with myself and just trying to fit into the career that was not fulfilling.
Yeah. It's interesting as you say that. I have a gentleman I coach, and he's in venture capital, and he has a saying. And the saying is that knowledge leads to conviction. So it's interesting because you said, hey, I've been studying this category for this many years. So you had knowledge, which at the end of the day, when you have knowledge, you can be more convicted and maybe misunderstood oftentimes by people that say, wait, you're going to do what? But the fact that you had the knowledge, you had conviction, as, you know, more so than if you were just saying, hey, I don't know much about this, but you know, my great grandmother Helen used to eat like this, and I could do something here with it. You know, you had the basis of knowledge to get yourself over probably some fear hurdles.
I like that. I just wrote that line down.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, when you, it's sort of like you've stayed at a Holiday Inn and you know just enough to be dangerous, yeah. But you really don't know. But if you've studied something and you've let your mind go and you've answered a ton of the hard questions, it's always going to be the unknowns, then you really can form much more conviction about taking what seems like on its face absurd risks.
Yeah.
But actually, to the person doing it, there's a lot of courage behind it with good reason.
Yes. So with that, what's step one? You know, you decide you're going to leave, you know, your job that you've had and been a part of for such a long time. And now you say, okay, day one, like, first, how does that idea, it comes to you, but like, how do you get going on something like that?
So first things first, I did try to have my cake and eat it too a little bit, right? Okay. Where I was doing this while still providing for the fam. So the really first step was to just have an honest conversation with my boss. And so that there were no burnt bridges, that this was, you know, look, I am passionate about investing and about entrepreneurship. And right now, I believe at this point in my life, I need to do this.
Yeah.
And I want you to know that, right? He gave me a shot 20 years ago to join his firm and improve myself. And you owe that candor and transparency to the people that you admire and respect. So that was first. And I was really worried about that conversation, as you can imagine. I was like, yeah. I couldn't sleep. Because once you state that, you've crossed the Rubicon, right? You can't put that genie back in the bottle. Your true motivations, everything's out there. But what I was so pleasantly surprised with was that he kind of knew. He's like, when you talk about these food startups, you light up, right? And it's much more tangible. I can see it, the fire, when you're discussing trends that you believe in and think are going to be big in health and wellness. Versus when you're analyzing, you know, a software company or a business services company and building a spreadsheet. And I really appreciated that. So with his support, honestly, it made the leap even better. As far as first step, most people get stuck on taking any action. The idea dies in their mind. And every excuse is made to, oh, someone else has, you know, I've seen this in the market, or this idea isn't as big as I think it can be, or I don't know where to start, or I don't have the capital, I don't have whatever. And I was listening to your conversation with Chris Kirby of Ithaca Hummus, a brand I absolutely love. And he has a very organic story of starting as well, which is just start the damn thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, fill up your car, make the stuff, go to a farmer's market, get feedback. Don't write a business plan that says I'm going to be a $1 billion brand. Go out and sell a few tubs of hummus.
Yeah.
Go out and sell a few bags of rind.
Yeah.
And most people, I think, get too stuck on how am I ever going to get this to be something big? Mm. Well, you're not unless you start. But it's hard. I get it. And, you know, for me, I went out to California, met with the grower that I had been in conversations with for many months, had made a big purchase of raw material, fruit, met with a dehydrator, met with a co-packer. So I had lined up these pieces in place. And this was my first time meeting them in early 2018. And the first production run was 100 cases of product, which is 1,200 bags.
Wow.
And I brought home on the plane a duffel bag filled with 200 bags. The TSA agent was like, okay. But I had the other 900, 1,000 delivered to me on a truckload in a pallet to my doorman building in New York City.
Yeah. Oh, that had to be a real.
When that truck pulled up, it got real in a hurry. But I loved it because then you become a salesperson right away. You got to move this product. You got to evangelize. You got to get the first store, restaurant, cafe, whoever to take it.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, I think about probably in the consumer goods space like this, you know, or food, you know, people probably get jammed up on the packaging, or they see what packaging that has evolved for some brands over 5, 10 plus years, what it looks like, and they compare it to their, you know, Gen 1 packaging. And some people can't, they just can't deal with that. And that's where they go to die, right? That idea and dream.
That's one of those excuses where, you know, they spend too much time focused on the glamorous side of the business, which is, oh, this is going to be the most gorgeous looking package. It's going to pop on shelf. That matters. Don't get me wrong. But if that's where your focus is and not on the blocking and tackling of, wow, how do I get certifications to be a food manufacturer? How do I get barcodes and UPC so this product can scan? How do I get incorporated as an LLC or a C Corp? How do I file trademarks? That's not sexy stuff. That's execution. And if you're saying, oh, the packaging looks great, I want to move the apple here, I want to move the strawberry here, you're just playing company. You're not building the business. And so you're playing brand. And you got to go out and do the unglamorous stuff and see if you want to do it. And then wrap it in beautiful packaging. You know, we did take the time to do both. I think we got it right where we had really awesome packaging out of the gates. It's funny, I look back at Gen 1 now and it's changed so much, but it looked great then. I'm still very pleased with the first iteration. But I know of brands for whom a packaging change altered the whole trajectory of their business for the positive. It's quite amazing. So it matters, but you got to get the key elements locked in before that.
Yeah. It's like one of my buddies is Kevin Plank from Under Armour, and he says, the first thing any great entrepreneur should do is to make sure that their product can sell and that there's consumer viability for that product. And once you have that, then you just keep selling, you know, and that's, you know, you see the evolution of this is why I love speaking to folks that have started, you know, consumer brands like this, because there it's such a journey along the way, and you see the evolution of product, and you see, you know, the website starts to change and the social media starts to change and the packaging starts to change and the team starts to build. And it's a very cool process. And most people just, you know, they see all these SKUs and all these brands on the grocery store shelves, but every one of them has a story behind it.
It is such a story for each brand. I have a unique appreciation for that now. All the gatekeepers and, you know, slammed doors you're going to get before you can get the authorization to get on a shelf at a Wegmans, at a Whole Foods, on Thrive Market.
Yeah.
And the ones that do it are the ones that are really, again, you have to have a product that resonates with people. And, but you also have to really be willing to spend a lot of time on the unglamorous side of entrepreneurship that doesn't get enough discussion, and be incredibly inquisitive and surround yourself with as many good people and advisors that you can collect to help you minimize your mistakes. You're going to make a ton, but I think if you can, you know, minimize them through your network and through asking all the questions you can up front, you're in a good spot.
Matt, what was your first sale? I'm sure you remember it. Where was it? When did it happen? How'd you feel?
Well, what I love about it is it's still an account of ours. So, you know, it was my favorite sandwich shop down in Greenwich Village. It's called Court Street Grocers.
Okay.
They now have 4 locations. They had 2 back then. And back to the day when that truck pulled up and a pallet of, you know, 80 cases of product came off, that stuff has a clock attached to it. Like I can't, you know, leave that in the storage locker of my apartment building, you know, for more than a couple of weeks. It's dried, so it's shelf stable, but still it was like a sense of urgency. Mm. And so I had a plan, but my first sale was an up and down the street account, which I love. That's where you're going to learn the most. And I was bringing product samples. I distributed everything myself. I didn't have a big distributor yet. I, you know, same story as Chris, true of others, which is like, you kind of just got to knock on those doors and experience the wins and the rejections firsthand yeah. to know what's working and where you can lean in. Court Street Grocers, they had a lot of chips and stuff that went great with sandwiches, but you didn't feel good about when you finished the whole bag afterwards. Yeah. And I sort of came in with that pitch that, hey, we're this edgy fruit snack brand. We keep the skin on to maximize nutrition, minimize food waste. Left them with some samples. Got an email from, you know, the buyer who was also the sandwich maker, was also the cashier. You know, they super yeah. tiny shop. And they said, we'll take 4 cases. And I was like, all right.
We're in business.
Oh, that rush was like, all right, let me go find every little sandwich shop, bodega, where I believe our customer who doesn't know us yet would, you know, gravitate to a product like this.
And I'm guessing too, you know, in those sort of settings and those environments and that size of store, and it's pretty much going to be mom and pop for the most part. They get you. They get a startup entrepreneur. They're willing to give you a shot. And it feels damn good to see your product in any store at that point, right? Even today.
I go back to the posts I made, and I was, you know, at one point I was like, Rind is available in 3 locations in New York City. And it was like, I felt like I was blanketed my home turf, and I was in like 3 small shops. But that is the start of the flywheel. You've got to build it. But I think that was the fulfillment of the very first, how do I get this idea? How do I start asking the right questions, finding the right suppliers, putting the pieces of that puzzle together, and then closing the loop was getting that first sale. And then it is repeat.
Yeah.
Repeat that cycle, grow it, learn from it, you know, cultivate your super fans and double down on them and listen to them. All that I think is kind of, it started with this Court Street Grocers, and it's so cool. I get emails from the same buyer and she says, I now see your stuff in Whole Foods or whatever. We don't have this flavor. Like, I want another 4 cases. And it's just, oh, it's the best.
It's cool. It's validating your idea every time an email like that comes in, or you get a call from somebody that says, hey, we want more, we need more.
Yep. It's great. And it was such a different skill than what I was doing in finance, where I had no business analyzing other people's amazing entrepreneurial dreams and passions, and then offering advice. It's absurd to say, I know, you know, if you were to invest more here, your margins would be this or that. It's like, who am I to opine or weigh in on how you should run your business when I hadn't even sold a single, you know, item before? And I just, that really felt like it was missing for me. You had to get messy. You had to figure it out. You had to realize just how damn hard it was.
Yeah.
And, you know, building something has been ultimately what I recognize now was missing. Yeah. It was a lot of what investors do. And I love identifying big winners early. But at the end of the day, we're the spectators. The investors are the spectators.
Yeah.
And they're not the builders. They're not the athletes. And I wanted to immerse myself in the hardest part, which is, against all odds, can I build a brand that has connection to a customer?
Yeah. And it's a very rewarding process. And even that dirty work is probably what makes it even more rewarding, because you've been through it. And that's why I love to speak about the first sale and the first, you know, business that said yes to your product. It's It's just an amazing validator of the effort, the time, the energy, the years before you even started, and you started right when you started thinking about it.
Yeah. So it's, I also just love that it wasn't a family member of mine buying it online because it was like, wow, someone I don't know, a real stranger. You're right. It's a rush. And I think once you get that first one, the competitive fire just gets dialed up to level 11 because you find what you want to be doing. You got to make it happen.
Yeah. Keep it going. Keep it burning every day. Another log in the fire.
Exactly.
So yeah. For you, where's the brand today? I mean, we know where you started and what it's been like. Where are you guys today?
So I love the mentality of, you know, Jeff Bezos talks about it, that every day is day one.
Yep.
And it still feels like there's opportunity everywhere. It's not like we are in every household in America. It's or every grocery store. We're in about 3,000 grocery stores today from just the one Court Street Grocers back in the day.
Yep.
And that's happened in about 3 years. So exciting, turbocharged growth. Some of the most respected food retailers in the country, like Whole Foods, Wegmans, Fresh Market. We're in 2,000 CVS stores. So what has been really illuminating is all the alternative channels that are right for a shelf-stable snack. Unlike Chris's business, we don't need to be refrigerated.
Yeah.
So we can be in airports. In Hudson News, we can be in, online marketplaces like Thrive Market and or Amazon. So those are some of the channels we're really excited about for Ryan today. I'd say the other big growth opportunity is a new product line that we launched. So back to that point about having a brand that has stretch and platform capability to it. This summer, we launched a line of crispy fruit chips.
Mm.
So we innovated off of our chewy dried fruit line and developed a crispy, craveable, crushable alternative to fried potato chips. And we did it using thin cut pieces of fruit. Here's an example. This is just beautiful orange slice, super thin, amazing with craft cocktails, it's crunchy and it delivers on everything we love about a tortilla chip, but with vitamin C and fiber that those guys never had.
You know, it's interesting, right? When you showed that, and you even before that, when you started speaking of it, I said, man, there's gotta be so many alternative uses to this product outside of just, hey, I want a snack. I'm thinking, bartenders, chefs, right?
Just get it all the time.
It's fresh. It's new. It's like, everybody's got croutons, but who's putting crispy fruit and things like that on their salads and such.
Exactly. And it really does amp up the nutritional profile. Naturally provide 2 to 3x the fiber and the vitamin content versus, stripping away the peel.
Yeah.
And so there's a good reason why your mom reminded you. That's the best part. And my great grandma, they knew what they were talking about. And that's what we are very excited about is orange chips in particular, which are tangy. They're much lower in sugar than apple chips, which are a big business on their own, lower carb, and just they deliver a ton of benefits. And nothing in the snack set, in the chip set, which is mostly corn or grain-based or potatoes, has any functional benefit. Maybe a little bit of protein, maybe a little bit of fiber. But what we have come to market with is a line of effectively immunity chips that can deliver a huge amount of vitamin C and still hit that craveable crunch that people look for in a chip.
Yeah, that's cool. It's unique, and even as you're speaking about it, I'm saying, hey, what are some comparables that I've had that are comparable to this? And yeah, I can't think of any. So it makes it very unique product.
Exactly. And that's what's exciting is, with dried fruit, with our core line, which is more chewy, it felt like we were improving an existing market.
Yeah.
We were making it cooler. We were making it more functional. It was waking up this sleepy category. With these rind chips, it feels like over a new category where we're blurring the lines of what salty snack can be. It can be fruit-based, and maybe it has some chili lime seasoning on it that mimics, you know, a margarita or right. What someone looks for with, you know, a salty craveability. And so a mix of sweet, savory, tangy, sour, I think that's where taste buds are going. And yeah. That's what we're excited to explore.
Yeah, you hit the whole profile there. I got just two more quick questions for you. One, what would you say, you know, every entrepreneur has points of resistance and friction points in building their brand. For you, what's the biggest one that you deal with now? Where you're at, what you're dealing with, what provides, I guess, the most friction to you as you try to grow this brand, Ryan?
Yeah, great question. I think making sure we're building this, because when you're growing really, really rapidly, I think there's a lot of propensity to take shortcuts, whether it's in the quality department, whether it's in the hiring department, whether it's at that point yet. And it's been very purposeful. And I want to make damn sure, as it relates to friction, that I am as in, you know, I don't want to be a micromanager, but I want to be as involved in every aspect of the business, whether it's receiving every customer support email,
yeah.
you know, and being in the flow. I have to know what's working and what's not, and not delegating everything to, you know, a new person that comes in. So it's kind of controlling the culture and the core values, and at least making sure we're building like a replicable process where it's not just my vision. I'm not going to go far if I can't get other people to help me run through walls together.
Yeah.
But I also need to make sure there's the right amount of training and culture building,
right,
that everyone gets where we're going and what the opportunity is. And so that's the biggest source of friction, is making sure we can keep everything up to the high standards I have for this business as we scale.
Cool. Yeah, I love it. It's like, so, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, they want to try to get out of that as fast as they can, but it's in that where you do the great, where you get truly those lessons and the learning that you can't get in a spreadsheet or just looking at the numbers we did for today.
Yeah. No, people talk about the messy middle, where you kind of just, you got to embrace it. So, you know, what your customers are saying, doing extensive reference checks on every hire. When you're a 5-person team and you're adding a 6th person, you better vet that person. They're going to be a key part of your culture.
Yeah.
And I want everybody on my team, even if it's not the area of expertise that we're hiring for, to meet those individuals, even if it's just, you know, in the hybrid world we live in a 30, 45 minute Zoom, but I want everyone's opinion. Can we all vibe and gel here? And so it's working. You know, I hope it continues to work as we grow and, you know, really build a big business here.
Yeah, it's great. I just wrote about that. I have a book that just came out, Habits of a Champion Team. And that's one, when it comes to hiring, I said, wouldn't it be great if more people did a group interview with all team members or the ones that were, you know, give them a say as to who's getting hired here and make sure that there's a complete culture fit. And then as a team, we make that decision. It's a very unique way to go about things.
I love that perspective of, you know, your habits are what define you.
Yeah.
I know you've written extensively about that, and it really resonates with me.
Yeah. Well, with that, I have one more for you. I call this the Becoming a Champion show. I feel like we're all on a journey to become a champion at what it is that we do, who it is that we are. What does the word champion mean to you?
So we have a core value that is our number one North Star, which ties into that question, which is this concept of rindness. And what I mean by that is we as a company have a charge of kill them with rindness. And what I mean by that is, to be a champion, you are successful when you kill them with rindness. And what that means is, have a competitive fire, be a winner, go after something you believe in, but do it in the nicest possible way. Don't win at someone else's expense. Don't take shortcuts. Do it the right way, and do it with humility. Do it with gratitude, and know that it's bigger than you. And we do that. We imbue the experience that we have around rindness with everybody, from a customer who buys a single bag, you know, at the grocery store, to, you know, our largest retailer. Every partner, everybody's perspective is important. And that's how we're going to win, is if we can leave them with this unbelievable impression of our brand about going above and beyond, you know, to deliver the best snacks in the kindest possible way. That's what we mean by that.
Ah, I love it. It's great. And it's totally aligned to the brand that you want to build. It's got branding in it, right? Killing with rindness. It's cool, man. That's what it's all about. So that's why you're going to win and continue winning. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode as much as I did. One of my favorite things to do is interview founders in the food and beverage space, because it is so competitive and it is so difficult to make it. So watching somebody like Matt and listening to his story, how he created really his own category and is working to strategically create disruption in this category, is awesome. So I hope he inspired you. I know he inspired me. And take a risk. If you're somebody that's on the sidelines and thinking about something, take a risk, make it happen, dive in, and take a chance on yourself. That's what Matt inspired me to do, and I hope he inspired you to do the same. So check out Rind, check out other episodes of the Becoming a Champion show, and every week we're going to come back at you and with you with some great content to motivate and inspire you to take action. This is Coach Dana Cavalia, and I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Becoming a Champion show. And if you did, give us a like, give us a share, give us a thumbs up, and show us some love. I'll talk to you soon. See you next week.